Hotel history is created for adult audiences. Content may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to Hotel History. We take you with us through the sordid history and scandals of some of the world's most famous and infamous hotels. I'm Dieta.
And I'm Yael. Let's get started.
Today we are headed towards England.
Across the pond.
Is that accent not good?
It's not bad.
I think it was good.
So we are headed to a place on the coast of the English Channel called Bournemouth.
Bournemouth or Bournemouth?
It's spelled like mouth, but all the English people I listened to pronounced it muth, Bournemouth.
Bournemouth?
Yeah.
Well, those English can't spell or can't read. I don't know.
They like to shorten it up.
Well, I have to say, we screw up a lot of English words because, you know, Wilshire mm-hmm. is spelled Wilshire, and that's how they pronounce it in England.
Hmm.
Because I made this mistake when I worked at the Wilshire, at the Beverly Wilshire, briefly. And I kept on saying, "Welcome to Beverly Wilshire." And they're like, "What the fuck are you saying?" And I'm like, "That's how it's spelled." And obviously, I was new to LA too. So thank God I didn't know about Wilshire Boulevard. but it's. So this is the reverse.
Yes.
Reverse. Okay. So we'll pronounce it however we want.
Yeah. I keep trying to call it Bournemouth, so
that's worse.
Yeah,
burn that's way mouth. Worse. So. That's how the Australians pronounce it.
So this is about 2 hours, I believe, from London by train. So, you know, London is kind of on the southeast portion of.
Sure. Yeah, I knew that.
Of the island. And Bournemouth is more like directly in the center of the southern coast.
Okay, but it is coastal still.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that is what draws people to this region. Is it's supposed to be a lot more temperate, really nice.
It's a beach town.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about this area because we found out that England used to have their own borscht belt.
Yeah, this is the British borscht belt.
The British borscht, yeah. And it was really the British Bournemouth. But it's no longer what it used to be. But we're going to get into the history and one of the most famous hotels that resided there for a long time. It was for there for a few decades, right?
Yes. Yes, it's really interesting the parallels actually that this area has with our own borscht belt because they had a similar trajectory.
Yeah, similar. It's like you live in the big city, you drive 2 hours away mm-hmm. to a nice place, and you get everything done for you.
Yeah. you live it up for the week or two that you get to have for the summer. And then you go back
yeah,
to the horrible city.
It is similar to the borscht belt. That is, it was predominantly Jewish, and Jewish families went to these hotels to escape the heat and for health reasons. But before we go into the details of the specific hotel, we want to go into a little bit of the history of England's Jews.
Yes. So Jews first arrived in England around 1070 during the reign of William the Conqueror. So they came over from the Norman area of France and were there for a couple of centuries until their expulsion in 1290 by King Edward I.
Yeah, he was an asshole.
Yeah, he basically overtaxed them until they had nothing left and then said, "Oh, well, you're of no use to me now. Get out."
So it was Jews escaping from being expelled from one place to another place until finally 600 years later. Well, a few hundred years later from King Edward I.
Yes.
But it was during Oliver Cromwell's rule that allowed a group of Sephardic Jews to be living in London in 1656, and they were allowed to stay there even though Jews were never officially readmitted to the Commonwealth.
Yeah, they just decided, okay, well, we won't officially readmit you, but we won't enforce this edict anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting to learn that the original Jews that got to stay were Sephardic Jews, because then an influx of immigrants, usually Eastern European immigrants, came to London at the turn of the 20th century due to pogroms and other issues that Jews faced. Which is what I think of when I think of British Jews, mm-hmm. mostly Ashkenazi Jews. So now England lets the Jews in. It's very nice of them. And they all kind of are there in British society. And it's now becoming more popular to vacation. And Jews are kind of gaining success. But I also think this point in history in general for most people in Western societies is that now is the time where, you know, there's a lot of prosperity. People have some extra income. Mm-hmm. They go on vacations. They, you know, they can go away during the summer months. The world is changing, and Jews were a part of that.
Yes. Well, and especially for the children of the immigrants, it became, you know, it wasn't really a part of shtetl life to get to take vacations. You were poor and you worked hard every day of your life except Shabbat. So now they're getting to actually have this a little bit of extra income, and they are saying, oh, we see all of these other people here going on vacation, and you know, that's the fashionable thing to do. And so they want to take part in this culture. And so that's when going away to the seaside started to be a possibility.
Yeah. And I think a big difference between, you know, the Jews and other members of society is that even though they were assimilated, they were still pretty observant. They wanted their own communities. You know, they still wanted people to marry within their community, other Jews. They were going to keep kosher and Shabbat. And that's why they gravitated towards a specific area with a specific hotel and that accommodated their needs. Like, otherwise, why wouldn't they just go to the local, you know? Because they didn't have, I'm pretty sure that in England, they didn't have this anti-Semitism that they had going on in the U.S.
Not
quite the same, where like Jews couldn't go to the hotels,
right?
And it was
right.
out of, like, you know, necessity. It was more like they just wanted to be catered to as Jews, and that's where they felt at home.
Yeah, so here's where the history of Bournemouth and its, you know, being a vacation getaway mirrors the Catskills, because originally people went there first who were in ill health and needed the sea air to help them through whatever illness they had. And so people are going there to convalesce. And so a lot of, you know, boarding houses and very small guest establishments got started first, just like in the Catskills. And then as popularity grew, people started to hear about it, more and more started coming. That's when actual hotels started needing to be available to accommodate all of these guests. And so that's when we start seeing in the around the 1920s, 1930s, this is all starting to pick up. And then right around the 30s and 40s is when we have the big eight, the hotels that really came to be known.
And that's the difference also between here and the Borscht Belt, because you couldn't, there was way more than the big eight in the Catskills.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously England's going to be way smaller. Like, it's, I mean, there's a drastic difference, but it would be like the big 200.
Yeah, like the Catskills had thousands of hotels and bungalow colonies and bed and breakfasts, whereas Bournemouth and the surrounding areas had hundreds.
Yeah.
So the Big Eight became internationally known for their luxury and high standards, not seen anywhere outside the U.S., and they were all located in the area of Bournemouth known as East Cliff, which also was nicknamed the Jewish Mile.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So the first four, East Cliff Court, the Ambassador, East Cliff Manor, and the Green Park, opened before or during World War II. And then they were joined by four other Jewish hotels after the war, the Majestic, the Langham, the Normandy, and the Cumberland.
So each hotel became popular with a specific group of people from a specific part of the country. So, for example, the Normandy became popular with families from Manchester, and whole families from Leeds stayed at the Majestic. The Ambassador was favored among continental Jews, and the Green Park eventually began to specifically attract guests from America, especially after the owners took a trip to New York in the 70s. So I'm assuming they went to the Catskills, and they probably...
Probably so, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, each hotel had to do with a certain... It probably was a little classist.
Probably, yeah.
And they wanted to be around their own community, which is very similar to even today in the Catskills. You go to a certain bungalow colony depending on where you're from.
So although most of the guests at these hotels were Jewish, which makes sense because they were all kosher hotels, non-Jews could be found at some of the hotels. Sometimes they were friends of Jewish guests, but not always. At the Cumberland, there was an inquiry from a non-Jewish couple about staying there, and they asked what the difference was about staying in a Jewish hotel. The hotel told them the main difference was probably that there was no bacon for breakfast, which they didn't care about because they were vegetarians. So they came to stay.
Okay.
Yeah, they were like, yeah, cool.
If you really love bacon, don't stay at a Jewish hotel.
Yeah. Another thing that I thought was interesting, so the Green Park was like the top tier of these Big Eight. It was considered the most luxurious, the nicest. And so they, even though they were all technically each other's competition, they didn't necessarily act like it. Like, they didn't try to undercut each other or lure guests away. They sort of like kind of had a hierarchy that they stuck with. Like, everybody knew the Green Park was going to be the most expensive, so they would let the Green Park set their prices for the season, and then everybody else would set theirs somewhere underneath depending on like the pecking order.
Interesting. Yeah, there wasn't enough to be that competitive.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, but it's so interesting because like I remember talking about the Borscht Belt, how there was a lot of competition. It was like, oh, they put in an Olympic-sized pool. Well, we're going to put in a golf course and two pools.
Yeah, it was the opposite.
Yeah.
But maybe that's just the American way. So not only did Jews go to these hotels in the summer, but they also went during the major Jewish holidays. So like Passover and the High Holy Days, like Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot. During Passover, the hotels would shut down for a full week before the holiday started because they had to prepare it, like the kitchens and the dining areas, to clean it out for any trace of what is called chametz, which is kind of, I want to say like breadcrumbs is like an easy way, but it's not necessarily breadcrumbs, but any trace of non-Passover food. It has to be spotless. And they have to re-kosher the kitchen and get a whole new set of dishes. It's a lot of work to make it like Orthodox level of kosher for Passover. Ask any mother, Jewish religious mother for the holidays, specifically Passover. My mom hates Passover.
I can only imagine how much relief the women must have felt knowing that they were going to be going to the Green Park or a similar hotel for the holiday.
But that's how it still is. People go away for Passover. They go on resorts that take care of everything. It's such a headache. There's so much work. But those resorts are really expensive. But they apparently were doing it. And they also had their own sukkah during Sukkot.
Yeah, I was reading that the roof of the sukkah was where they had it, where it could roll back. It was electric. They could roll it back and forth to open it up to be able to see the sky or close it if it was going to rain.
Oh, that's so cool. I want that.
I know.
And people also came to stay for a 10-day stay over for Christmas and New Year's, since a lot of people had time off from work. And the hotels would serve lavish buffets each night. And at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, they would serve breakfast.
That sounds like so much fun.
Why don't they have this anymore? I want to go for a 10-day stay over for Christmas and New Year's.
Well, I mean, you could. That it just wouldn't be a package. You'd have to pay for each night.
No, I know. But I just wish there was something like an event, like a thing where that's really cute.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are at some places, but I just don't. It wouldn't be the same, I'm sure. The same level of detail.
It's not the same. And you want like, it's a whole thing. There's something, I like communal events to an extent, as long as it's not forced, where like, you know, everyone's participating in this. And that's why I like holidays, and people are like, oh, it's so stupid. But I'm like, how often do we have total strangers all partake in the same thing?
Yeah.
And the same day. That's why I think those things are kind of special. And people try to demean it, but I'm like, shut up.
Yeah. Hello. It brings people together. That's sort of the point of a holiday. So getting to Bournemouth was not such a big deal, especially if you were from London. Everybody originally came by train. In the 50s and 60s, driving became more common, and the wealthiest among the patrons would be driven by their chauffeur, of course. So they actually had dedicated trains going to Bournemouth from London Waterloo Station. The Bournemouth Bell was a popular train. It had Art Deco decor, comfortable seats, and refreshments, even though it was only a two-hour ride.
That's my kind of train.
Yeah, it sounds so nice.
Does this still exist?
No, I don't think so. Because now everybody just drives.
Yeah.
People coming from the northwest of England traveled on a train called the Pines Express.
I feel like this is half of the adventure.
Yeah. If you were a child, imagine.
Yeah, but there has to be trains still now.
Oh, yeah, there's still trains that go. They're just not like dedicated, I think, to only doing this. So families traveling very long distances would end up staying with relatives overnight or travel on sleeper trains. But that doesn't sound nearly as nice as the Bournemouth Bell.
Yeah. The Bournemouth Bell, they got to bring that back.
Yeah.
The highlight of this episode about the Bournemouth is the fanciest hotel, the Green Park.
So there's actually a really good documentary. It's just called The Green Park Hotel, right? Or The Green Park?
The Green Park.
The Green Park.
Yeah.
It was really nice, and it gives a really great overview and interviews with the family members and former guests who are still alive. It has a lot of heart in it.
It was done really well.
Done really well, yes. So the Green Park building was built in 1937 in the Art Deco style. And it was originally run as a residential hotel, which gave it a really special touch that most other hotels did not have at this time, which was that each of its bedroom had a private bathroom.
Which is so rare, apparently.
Yeah, this was really unusual back then. So I think that's probably another element that they just kind of lucked into that made it seem so luxurious.
Yeah. Honestly, still pretty luxurious. I think a lot of people who have roommates in one bathroom can tell you.
So it opened on October 15th, 1943. The new owners were Ruby, and Sarah Marriott, who had been running the Sandringham Hotel in Torquay.
Their name is not related to Marriott Hotels. We should say that because I got confused. They changed it from Maravich to Marriott. And The hotel was run by the whole family, including Sarah's mother, Bubby Richmond, and her sisters, Helen, Hannah, and Rachel, and Judy. There were a lot of sisters. So Helen, yeah. Hannah, Rachel, and Judy.
This was very much a family-run enterprise.
Well, Rachel went by Ray. Hannah, Ray, and Judy never married. They were too married to the hotel. That's the excuse.
Yeah.
But I will say this. When you don't, Bubby Richmond was already passed when they made the documentary, as she was old.
Yeah.
Even a long time ago, she was old. But they give a good description of this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I met her.
Oh, yes.
She sounds like such a baller. Like, she was like drinking every day, smoking cigars. I don't know if she was smoking.
Yeah, she was this Orthodox Jewish woman, like wearing her shadel, her wig, wearing, you know, her from clothes, but then she would drink brandy and champagne every day, and she gambled and would cheat at cards.
Yeah.
Was like a notorious cheat.
She was hilarious. I mean, just some of the things they say, you can tell she had a personality.
Yeah, like she was the heart and soul of this place while she was alive. So the hotel actually opened during World War II, 1943, while there was a military ban on the southern coast. So its first guests were a mix of former guests of the Sandringham Hotel, which they had been running, families who had been evacuated to Bournemouth, and Jewish members of the Allied forces.
It's so interesting that hotels famously have been used during war. Mm. Like, so far, almost every hotel we mentioned was useful during World War II. And they were happy to do it. I don't think they had a choice, but you know.
Yeah.
But still,
but they all did their part.
Yeah. They were, it was like prideful, like, you know, we're happy to use this as a bunker or to help whoever, to spy on someone.
Yeah. Like, we're part of the war effort.
Yeah.
And we do. Exactly. In 1944, just before Passover, the hotel was forced to close due to the military's final preparations for the invasion of Normandy. But they already had the entire Seder prepared. All of the food was ready, everything. So Ruby and Sarah invited the Jewish soldiers that were stationed there from all the different Commonwealth countries, the U.S., Britain. All of these Jewish soldiers were able to come to the hotel and enjoy a Passover Seder, a kosher Passover Seder.
Yeah. I love this story. I feel like this whole sentiment of like, you have the opportunity to share or give is lost today.
Yeah.
I don't, maybe I'm wrong, but it's in the documentary and they, you know, go over like the huge crowds of people that came for Passover. But I don't know. I thought it was so sweet and thoughtful. And
yes, especially these soldiers are far from home. They don't know when they're going to see their families again, if they're ever going home at all. So to be able to all of a sudden find a little bit of community and home and Hamishness, you know, this comfort so far from home, I think was probably a huge blessing.
So the Green Park was allowed to continue as a hotel after this, I believe. But a lot of the other hotels were not. They had to be used for military purposes until after the war, right?
Yeah, a lot of the hotels were requisitioned by the military and couldn't function at all until the war was over.
That's harsh.
Yeah.
That's probably not so great on the business. Maybe that's why Green Park did a little better.
Yeah, because they opened kind of in the middle of it. So maybe all the other hotels had already been requisitioned.
Yeah, maybe. They didn't.
Because, some of the hotel owners decided to sell after they didn't want to come back and have to go through the issues of reopening.
Yeah.
So the owners of the Green Park dubbed their hotel the greatest name in Jewish hotels, but it was also known by others as the Kutchers of Bournemouth or the Bournemouth. See, I did it. As the Kutchers of Bournemouth or the Grossingers of Bournemouth. But one of the producers of the documentary actually said that the chefs there would come from, you know, the best places in the world. And so she liked to refer to it as it was Claridge's on sea, not Grossingers. So she's
even fancier.
Yeah. So she's comparing it to Claridge's in London, which is the sister hotel of the Savoy.
Yeah.
You know, opened by the same family. So they
High praise.
Yeah, they had a very luxurious view.
Yeah, the Green Park did seem a little bit more luxurious than the Grossinger's. Like, it just seemed like a different vibe, but I don't know if that's just British people versus American people.
So that's true.
Because, you know, if you speak in a British accent, you are automatically smarter, classier. Like,
we immediately put a layer of aristocracy on you.
I mean, just think about the Jewish accent versus like the British accent, even if you were Jewish. And I heard it a little bit. They have their own like unique accent. Yeah. But you just sound so much better than like, I'm from New York. What do you want? Rather than like, oh, we're going to go to Claridge's and have a cup of tea.
So a lot
at some point you're going to have to do a British accent, Deanna, not just me.
Nope. I only do French accents on this podcast.
It's not fair.
So in a lot of the staff for these kosher hotels were actually not Jewish, because it's really important for the functioning of a kosher hotel, especially during the Sabbath, to be able to have non-Jews that can keep doing things when Jewish staff members have to take time off. So in the late 1950s, the hotel employed a lot of Italian waiters, which actually added even more of a luxurious feeling to the hotel, because I guess a lot of the guests of the hotel had never had the experience of like a nice restaurant where they're going to pull the chairs out for you and put your napkin in your lap, like that very continental experience. So the way this happened is the Richmond sisters would often go to different hotels in different countries just to see what other people were doing, you know, what they could bring back.
That's the excuse they made.
Yeah, exactly. They were on vacation in Venice, staying at the Excelsior Hotel, when the owner actually asked them if some of his waiters could work at the Green Park for 6 months to learn English, because British tourism was starting to pick up in Italy. And he's thinking, oh, this could be a great exchange. The waiters actually, though, had a great time, because in Italy, they weren't really allowed to touch girls or talk to girls unchaperoned. It was very strict then, apparently.
What?
Probably, you know, very religious type setting, just in a different way.
You don't think Italians are prude. That is not the first thing.
Not anymore, but I guess maybe in the 50s.
Maybe they're rebelling from that time.
It could be. So they came to England and they're free to date. So many of them went on to marry the English girls they met or their fellow hotel staff members, and then stayed in the area and opened Italian restaurants. So that was the case for Nemo Zakia, the head waiter, for more than 20 years, who is actually interviewed in the Green Park film. He remembers coming to England with visions of Sherlock Holmes. So I'm glad to know we're not the only ones.
No, everyone has their stereotypes.
And he didn't get exactly the culture he was expecting.
Yeah.
But he obviously loved it enough to stay.
But they did talk about, like, when the Italian waiters came, everyone's like, ooh, who are the cuties?
Yeah.
Like, it was a vibe. They were very excited about the Italian waiters. In 1961, they built a heated outdoor pool, the first establishment in Bournemouth to have one. First of all, a heated pool, even in 1961? I mean, even now. So in 1961, that's pretty impressive. I don't know. To me, a heated pool is luxurious.
Yeah, to me too.
Because I always had to suffer in a not heated pool. Like, it's cold. Too bad. I'm turning blue. Oh, well. As numbers started to decline in the 70s, Ruby and Sarah traveled to America to attract more visitors, which was partially successful. I guess they had another reason to vacation.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, we're going to recruit guests. But in the 1980s, Ruby's health started to decline and the hotel closed in October of 1986. It was sold to Majestic Holidays. They ran it as a non-Jewish hotel, but then sold it in 1988 to developers who turned it into apartments named after the Green Park. So today it's apartments, but it's I mean, it's the Green
but
Park,
still
but
called it's the Green Park.
It's
yeah.
not, but it's nothing like yeah. how it was. When the film was made, Hannah and Judy were still living in their family apartment across the street from where the hotel was. Are they? Did they pass?
I'm not sure. I'm not positive when this hotel, or I'm sorry, when this film was released.
I think it was 2022.
I think it
or
was.
Something.
So and they may still be.
But then they said, like, I think in the beginning, some of these people
have
yeah,
passed.
Have
yeah.
passed. But.
Yeah, they yeah. were the only two family members still alive. So
that's
they
true.
May have passed.
Yeah. And so, of course, the Green Park attracted not just, you know, the upper crust of Jewish families, but it attracted a lot of famous people, and they had a lot of famous guests. Many of them were Jewish also, but some of them were Brian Epstein, who was the manager of the Beatles. I had no idea that the manager was Jewish.
I knew his name my whole life, but I never even thought about it. But yeah. Epstein.
That makes
duh.
Sense. Yeah, a lot of yeah. musician
a lot
managers.
Of managers.
he was a regular at the Green Park. And there were other guests that came to the Green Park that were pretty important. Business leaders, specifically Jack Cohen, Isaac Wolfson, Jarvis Astaire, and Alfie Esdale. So here's the thing about British successful people is that we don't know who they are. I looked up some of them, and I kind of get the gist. I think...
yeah, Jack Cohen was the Tesco...
Tesco,
founder,
yeah.
Right.
And Isaac Wolfson was also really successful. I forgot what he did. Also, three successive chief rabbis came to stay. Rabbi Hertz, Rabbi Brody, and Rabbi Jacobowitz. Oh, and then also Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks.
Yeah. He's in
the documentary. So he, it must have been filmed before because he did pass away.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I wonder when they got that film. He passed away a few years ago. But they really got like a lot of people to come to the hotel. It was very well known. And when you watch the documentary, when they're interviewing people, they say they're excited when, you know, these famous people come in and they act like everyone else. And they even like gave some helpful business advice to some people. It was really interesting to see the cultural differences between the British Jews and the American Jews.
Yeah.
Cause I feel like the American Jews would not have been so subtle. I think they would have been more.
Probably not. Just thinking yeah. about all of the photos that people would take with all of the yeah. famous athletes that came to train.
Yeah. They were like, oh my God, when Elizabeth Taylor came, woo!
Yeah.
You better believe people were not subtle about that one. But yeah, it sounds like the Green Park had this amazing, history and it was sounds really influential for the area. But of course, like many things, it has to come to an end. It did not survive after a certain point, like many Borscht Belt hotels. Mm-hmm. But because of increasing popularity and affordability of overseas travel, caused many families to just vacation in different areas like Spain, Israel, and Florida, and probably a bunch of other areas. And of course, you know, plane travel, the same reason there was the decline of the Borscht Belt is the same reason there was a decline of the Bournemouth. So eventually what happened was that after many years, only two of the big eight hotels made it past the 1980s. And that's the Normandy and the New Ambassador. I think the New Ambassador eventually did close. And the Normandy is still around today, but it's mostly Hasidic Jews that yeah. go, and it's also still kosher, but it doesn't have the same, this area doesn't have the same like allure as it once did.
Yeah.
For Jews.
A lot of the hotels that closed ended up being demolished and replaced with apartment buildings. However, those apartment buildings were often bought by the Jewish families who had
yeah.
been coming to stay at these hotels. It just buying a vacation home was starting to become the more popular thing to do. Yeah. And then a lot of the Jews, if their favorite hotel closed, then they would still come and they would just go to a non-kosher hotel.
But it's not the same.
No, it's not the same. You lose that. But it's not like the Catskills where the hotels went and everybody went with them. The Jews kept coming. They kept living in Bournemouth. They were still able to stay. The whole area is still a vacation area. But this beautiful, you know, time capsule of a situation declined.
Yeah. And we should also mention that, like, well, two major things about the similarities between the Borscht Belt and Bournemouth was that people did come out to recover from illnesses they had in the city, like the fresh air, the nicer weather. It really did. That was like that started a lot of it. And the kosher food that was all inclusive, that was constantly available to them. So like 6 meals a day or however, and the food was so important.
Yes.
But you have to, in the documentary, they talk about the food a lot. And honestly, if the competition really relies on the food, because if you have a Jewish hotel and you don't have enough food,
that will not last.
And
long.
You don't have good food. Oh, not only would they let you know, but they'll let you know with their wallets because they'd be walking out the door.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I have a schedule of meals from one of the hotels that I want to read over. It's insane. And I'd like to experience a couple days like this.
It's amazing.
It starts with tea and biscuits in bed.
Oh!
When you wake up.
They bring it to the door? Wow.
And then breakfast is served in the dining room. This is a kosher hotel, so it was a milk meal, which means that no meat is allowed. So it's something like eggs, fruit, cereal, different types of dried fish, toast, that sort of thing. Actually, the Green Park was famous for its trolley of 35 different types of jams and marmalades.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. So after breakfast comes 11sies.
Ooh.
Which I thought was just a Hobbit thing. I didn't know that was an actual British thing.
But I also thought 11sies was later in the day.
Well, it's at 11 a.m. It's 11sies.
That makes sense. Forget what I said.
So that was coffee and biscuits served in the lounge. Then lunch was served at 12:30. This was another milk meal. So you're going to be able to have starters, soup, fish, usually a choice of 3 different types of fish, grilled vegetables, potatoes. And then here you're going to have dessert, which would be a choice of 5 or 6 fruit dishes, a dessert trolley with fresh ghetto and cheesecake.
I want to say something. I'm hungry and full just listening to this list.
Yep. And then, of course, an ice cream dish like peach melba.
Then there's peach melba, our favorite thing in the world.
Then there's afternoon tea, which is beverages, cakes, sandwiches, available between 4 and 6 p.m., served in the lounge or on the veranda. Dinner was served at 7 or 7:30. This was the meat meal. So, of course, this is going to be like 3 or 4 courses. There's going to be hors d'oeuvres, pickled herring, Russian salad, soups, an entree. The main course is going to be veal, chicken, or beef, potatoes, vegetables, and then afterward, it's going to be followed by some sort of fruit dessert, cake, lemon tea and coffee, and then more cookies.
And then a midnight snack, right?
And then refreshments at 10 p.m. Tea, sandwiches, and cakes were served for those who felt that they could not survive the night until breakfast or had difficulty falling asleep.
Is this where the obesity epidemic started? Oh, mm-hmm.
Well, I read that a lot of hotels like had to have a doctor on call because of people having like angina issues.
Oh my God. That makes sense. And yet that doesn't stop the, instead of the hotel fixing that issue and saying, you know, we're not going to have all the snacks. They're like, you know what we should do? We just need a doctor because we're not going to stop anytime soon. But I love that. I love that for us.
So another similarity between the Borscht Belt and Bournemouth is that it was a great place for what's known as hatches and matches.
Oh, yeah.
So this is Jewish couples meeting and getting married and having babies and repeating the process over and over.
So I think this is really interesting because I feel like we need to bring this back to modern day life of like a meeting spot and of it not being a business, but just like a social gathering, maybe dances, whatever. But what I liked about hearing about all the hotels and the Catskills and here is they encouraged boys and girls to hang out and meet. And I wanted to say something. These were religious Jews. Growing up, we were very much deterred to talk to the opposite sex. They were like, no, you shouldn't hang out. Even though their generation before, the parents of these people, they were doing that. Because where else are we going to meet a Jewish boy, girl to get married? Mm-hmm. And I felt like it made sense because it was a safe kind of kosher environment. Like, you're outside, people are always around. Like, if kids are gonna go and sneak out, they're gonna go and sneak out. But at this way, it's, they don't need to hide.
Yeah,
you know, they can just talk and mingle. And I like that they encouraged that, and it was fun.
Yeah.
And in the documentary, they're like, there were a lot of babies being made.
It is true. And a lot of the couples that met on vacation there would have their honeymoon there. So I'm
That's
sure
so
a lot of
cute.
Families got started.
I love that.
Another similarity is that the Borscht Belt hotels and the Bournemouth hotels were usually family-owned businesses. They weren't, at least they didn't start out being owned by a corporation of or a chain of some sort. And so not only are they family-owned, but they're also, like, the women of the family are front and center and running them. Like, they handle a lot of the operation.
And they're successful.
Yes.
So they were women-run, not business, not corporation-owned, which made them really good. Because when you hear, when people talk about these hotels, they don't just like, yeah, it was nice. They have like a love for them. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we came in and we saw this woman who runs and owns the hotel in the lobby greeting us. Like, there was real human interaction. There's this... I used the word last time also, heimishness, and which means, like, how would you describe it? Like a,
like comfort, like, and homey.
Yeah,
and
homey. Yeah. You know, you don't have to go to corporate. You go to a person and they try to fix the problem, but you also knew the person, and it was like,
yeah, they know your name. They remember you from your visit the year before and the year before that.
Yeah.
They know your whole family.
And most of them probably, there's a relation or connection there. So it's not like far off. And there's this trust, this a communal trust with other people, which added to the heimishness and the safety of the hotel. And I think that gives it warmth. And I think people are really, really craving that. And for me, a lot of hotels just totally lack that.
Mm-hmm.
There is no hominess to it.
Yes, they're very cold.
Yeah, they're very cold. And I think also, I know there's a high turnaround with hotels, which is problematic. There's a lot of problems with hotels.
That's true.
But I think that if they took the Borscht Belt and the Green Park as an example, a model of how to run a hotel, to get people as if they are, like, these individuals invested in it and to treat it like their own little property home, I think that would change a lot, but things would have to change. It can't be so corporate, and they'll never give that up because, you know, whatever.
Profit.
But
yeah. Well, and that's one thing about these is it wasn't until like the 70s and 80s, really the 80s, that these hotels even offered the ability to stay just one or two nights because it was so popular. You had to take a week long booking if you were going to stay, or you would have to like share it with another family or something. Like, they take a week and you take a week because it was so popular that there was no other option. So you really spent a lot of time at the hotel, and that's how you got to know everyone so well, because you were not just, you know, coming in, going to sleep there for a couple nights and then heading back out.
Yeah.
You were living there for a minute.
Yeah, that's true.
One of the main differences that I was reading about was the entertainment. So in the Catskills, it was very dominated by Yiddish theater, Jewish humor. It was Jewish entertainment for this, you know, very insular Jewish audience, whereas Bournemouth Entertainment was a little bit more assimilated because the, you know, upwardly mobile British Jews had kind of left behind the more traditional Jewish leisure activities when they moved to the suburbs and further out, you know, away from their immigrant neighborhoods in London. So a lot of times when British Jews would visit the Catskills, they actually didn't care for the entertainment all that much. They thought, I learned this new term, they thought the stand-up comedy there could be much too blue. And so apparently blue humor is kind of a little bit on too the more risque side. Yeah.
That's funny coming from British people. I'm sorry. What? It also, they said it was too obviously New York. I mean, New York, that the accent thing.
Yeah.
And I think New York Jews are unique within Jews. Like, I don't think all Jews are like that, but they are the stereotype of like Jewish Americans for good reason, because that's mostly where most Jews in America live.
Yeah.
And we did kind of that, a lot of Jewish New York comedians. So we put it on the map, guys.
Yeah, I mean, well, the Catskills are 2 hours from New York. Like, of course it's going to be a New York Jewish.
But maybe it was too blue at the time.
Maybe so.
I think England has changed
probably
drastically from that. And now I feel like they're a little bit too blue for some Americans. But it's very interesting. And another major difference between them and the Catskills is that obviously the Catskills was in the Catskills Mountains, so they're going to have huge resorts, way bigger than Bournemouth. And I didn't know that they served more food than Bournemouth, but probably just number wise. Is that they're not talking about meals,
just amount,
the amount
of food.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Because they both probably had a ton of snack time and meals and 11Zs and whatever. But another major difference also was that when the Catskills resorts shut down, it tanked the entire region's economy, but Bournemouth's hotels were put to different uses and the town and area's economy remained intact.
Yeah.
Which sounds kind of good.
Yeah.
The Catskills really did go through it.
Yeah. And they're just now starting to kind of claw their way out of it. So it's much better that they were able to, you know, turn the hotels into apartments and find other uses to keep the area going.
Yeah, but it also makes sense because Bournemouth is a city. It's not like mostly Jews, but the Catskills, it was Hickville.
Yeah.
It was like really nothing going on. Very, very small towns. The farming wasn't great.
Yeah.
There's not much, and so it makes sense.
It's true. Yeah. So if you're interested in learning more about Bournemouth, then of course we recommend watching the Green Park documentary. And you can also check out the book Jews by the Seaside by Pam Fox. It goes very into detail on not only the Big Eight hotels, but also a lot of the smaller establishments and just the history and building up of the town of Bournemouth itself. And then I also found a novel called The Crossing Point by Gerda Charles that takes place in a Jewish hotel in Bournemouth and kind of just gives you the whole idea of all the different scenes that would play out with what it was like to, you know, go to a dance there, what it was like to see the food put out and the wave of people rush to get their next meal.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at when they show footage of the time, it looks like so fun.
Yeah.
I love watching that old footage.
Thanks for listening to Hotel History. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Patreon, and Substack by searching for Hotel History or Hotel History Podcast. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so we can reach more listeners.